This is Starters for the Rest of Us, episode 58. Welcome to Starters for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you built your first product or just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on, Rob?
All kinds of stuff, man. So cool. Well, I'm going to start off. So I have a long list as usual. I don't know if we'll get through all of it, but had to just tell folks, I got my Kindle Fire yesterday, and I'm shocked at how nice it is. They did a really good job with the hardware. It's got a nice rubberized back, and it's a small, you know, I was telling you, it's smaller form factor than an iPad. It's 7 inches, but basically for the way I use a tablet, it pretty much does everything that I need. So for $200, it's quite a steal.
Interesting. See, I haven't even considered getting one. I got an email from Amazon a couple of days ago that made me consider it because it said that you could stream movies from down to your Kindle if you had Amazon Prime.
Yeah, there's like 10,000, I think, free movies. And those are they're older films, right? It's like it's how Netflix streaming was when it first launched. Then I rent all my movies through Amazon now. I don't go like Blockbuster. I haven't gone in years. And then Redbox, I just don't go to Redbox to get the little DVDs. Mm-hmm. So everything I rent is through Amazon.
How do you put them out to your TV, or do you not bother?
I have a Roku.
Oh, okay.
Roku has the Amazon app. Yep. So the way I watch video these days is Netflix streaming and Hulu Plus and then Amazon. And all three of those have apps on the Kindle. And then the iPad doesn't have Amazon. There's no Amazon video app, but the other two are there. Yeah, it works really well, man. I've been impressed. I happen to have uploaded all my 20 gigs of music up to the Amazon cloud, you know, months ago when they launched Amazon Music. And so I had forgotten about it and I just popped into the music tab. And since I'm already logged in, you know, to the Kindle as my Amazon account, it just, you know, had all the playlists. I could just listen to my music, stream it right through my Wi-Fi, which is pretty cool. I never have to sync this thing with anything. It's just all cloud-based. So Obviously it's Wi-Fi only, right? There's no 3G. I've really been impressed with it. I can do everything that I do commonly do on my iPad, I can do on this Kindle, and the Kindle is smaller, half the price, same battery life.
But you've already paid for the iPad, so it's not like you're saving money by getting it. No, just pointing it out.
No. I totally agree. I mean, frankly, I'm considering, like, I'm not going to keep both these things. I'm going to sell one of them. But I can get, you can get several hundred dollars for an iPad one still. You can get like $300 or more on eBay for it. So, yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know which one. I'm certainly not going to keep both of them, but I'm just glad there's a viable competitor, because up to this point, like, there hasn't been a breakout Android tablet. I really think the Kindle Fire has a great chance at being an iPad competitor, not an iPad killer, but a really nice thing for more casual users, I think. Like, if my mom asked me what kind of tablet she should get, I would probably recommend the Kindle Fire over the iPad.
I remember seeing something from some of the Apple executives that said something about how they didn't see the Kindle Fire as an iPad killer. It was more of a different market. So yep. they saw it as something that could easily coexist with the iPad, but not necessarily something that competed head to head.
Yeah, I think it'll certainly take some market share, but I would agree. I mean, there's no camera on the Kindle Fire. Android is not as elegant as iOS, just in the usage. And so if you're really hung up on that.
You just offended like half the planet.
You think so? I
don't know.
Even people I know who like Android, I mean, it's a great OS, but there's certain things, very subtle things. I mean, it's like comparing Mac to Windows, where like Windows is great and usable, but Mac just has a certain feel to it that, you know, that Android doesn't.
I think you just took care of the other half of the planet.
Oh my gosh, nice. A couple of the drawbacks. One is the Kindle Fire is the screen's pretty small. So if you want to surf the web, it's not nearly as good of an experience as on the iPad. It's a lot harder to type. The keyboard's much smaller. So if you really do plan on doing much typing, it's a non-starter. I don't know if you can get a Bluetooth keyboard for it or not, or if that's even worth it. But that's my review. I don't want to talk too much about it. But I was impressed and very pleased that, you know, that someone else has come out with a viable alternative.
Mm-hmm. I looked at it and thought about it, but I don't really see a need for me to bring, you know, something else in that doesn't really add a whole heck of a lot. I mean, I do travel, and if I travel, the problem is that I run into most of the time is the fact that if I wanted to stream movies or videos or something like that, usually the hotel's internet is just so overwhelmed that it can't keep up with anything that you're doing anyway. And it's so, not like these are bad hotels either. I mean, everyone comes back to the hotel between 6 and 8, or and they're just on the internet the entire time. And, of course, right. people you will bring like an Apple TV or a Roku or stream things to their iPad, and this, the whole thing just gets overloaded.
Right. Yeah, you can actually download stuff as well. Like you can go to the music and just download an entire playlist all at once, and it'll download it to the hard drive, as well as videos. I have no idea how much onboard space is on the drive. I assume it's probably 8 gigs or 16 gigs, I would assume. But yeah. I haven't even paid attention. So I've never run out on my iPad. So, it's not even something I think about.
Yeah, I have the iPad that I got has 64 gigs of space. So
it's plenty
for a number of different movies. Wow. But I've also run into times where I'm like, I've got to start moving things around a little bit or make some judgment calls on which movie to take with me and which ones not to. So
Right.
Sometimes I'll be in the mood for different things. But
sure.
I don't know. Interesting take on the Kindle Fire.
For folks who are on like Android phones or Blackberries or Palms, hey, is anyone still on Palm? I offended the last 0.1% of the market that I missed with the others. There's this app called Stitcher. And because that's one thing I've heard is that, the cool thing about having an iPhone or an iPod is that the podcasting is really easy to consume. But the, Windows phones, Androids, Blackberries, it's just, there's not a great app for it until Stitcher came along. And so Stitcher is this, it syncs, they're over the air. And basically they contacted us. They said that they've had a bunch of requests for our podcast to be on Stitcher. I don't know whether to believe them or not, but somehow they heard about us. And so if you're a Stitcher user and you've been having trouble getting our podcast, you can now, I guess, search in their repository and find us, and then it'll automatically update if you want to subscribe. So that was a nice little thing to extend our reach a bit. Yeah, so I've been yapping for a long time. How about you? What's going on with AutoShark this week?
Well, I finished, I think, the last time we talked when we had Jason and Justin on, I was saying how I was working on adding the capability to have support more than one customer inside the system, and I finished that up. And in the process of doing so, I actually discovered a couple of security holes, and so I had to spend some time cleaning those up. And they weren't really major. You could see certain things. You could see policies and rules and stuff that other people had created, but you couldn't actually see the results of them. But I felt like it was something that really kind of needed to be addressed. So I spent some time working through those and fixing those problems. And today I reached out to my first prospective customer, sent him an email. I met him last year. He gave me his business card. So I shot him an email and just asked him if he could spend a little bit of time with me next week, taking a look at what I've built so far and kind of giving me some live feedback about it, I'll say. Unfortunately, next week, as you know, is Thanksgiving. So I don't know whether he'll even be around to take a look at anything I've got. So we'll see how it goes. But I've got some time next week where I can go do some cold calling, if you will, by just kind of dropping into a couple of different banks and seeing if they'll just take a look at it and give me some feedback.
That's cool. Well, that's exciting, man. It's like a big milestone to do the first email like that. I know you've already met with him, but
right.
I'm really interested to hear how that goes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that I really need to get taken care of still. I still don't have the ability to actually schedule the audits. And for that, I actually looked around and I said, well, do I want to build my own scheduling piece of this, or do I want to see if there's a library out there that I can use? And I found that there's a open source library called Quartz.net, which is for scheduling tasks and jobs. And it was originally based on a Java implementation, but it's been ported over to .NET. And it looks pretty full-featured. And I should be able to put it either out in the cloud so that I can pipe things to a queue on whatever schedule I want, or I may put the scheduling piece actually on the endpoints in the customer environment and then have it just pull out to the cloud on its own scheduled basis. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'll do both. But I've definitely got to get that in. And then there's a couple of other libraries that I ran into. One I hadn't really given a lot of serious consideration to, which is Log4Net, which a lot of people are probably familiar with because it's from the Apache Foundation. And it's pretty prevalent out there as a open source library for just logging different things. But I had my own internal logging mechanism for the application that I built a long time ago, and I never really pulled it out, but I could see how Log4Net would be useful in certain scenarios. And it's also used inside of another application called Top Shelf, which is an implementation of making a Windows service such that you compile down to an executable and then you call your executable with the install parameter, and it will actually install your executable as a Windows service, which is really kind of cool.
That is kind of cool. Yeah.
I've already got that capability that I built in a while back, but since I'm going to be incorporating probably Log4Net and Quartz.net anyway, it's kind of built in, so I may as well just start using Top Shelf as well.
Right.
I mean, it looks real easy to start to kind of switch over, and it would get rid of a lot of the, I suppose it would get, on one hand, it would get rid of a lot of the code that I wrote, but it would introduce a lot of code that I didn't write. So I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm kind of on the fence about that.
Trade-off, yeah, that's always hard.
Yeah, it does give me some more features, though. So, for example, when somebody goes to install it, I could pop up a box that says, please provide the credentials that you would like to, and you know, have this service run as.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's the thing, and you're never going to, but I bet you're just not going to have the time to add those little features to this piece of it. You know, you're to get those for free, basically, is nice, and then hopefully moving forward as it's supported, if there are bugs found, if it's open source, you can fix them, and if not, then they will get fixed automatically.
Right.
Assuming it's a supported project.
Mm-hmm.
That's tough. It definitely tough. I would lean towards using it if it's not too much headache to you know, swap it out.
No, it really doesn't look like it's too much of a headache. It's just a matter of biting the bullet and just doing it. And I'll probably need, I don't know, 6 or 8 hours to buckle down and rip out all the infrastructure that I've built to put, you know, all three of those things in there. I already have a piece that is kind of a multi-threaded portion of the code that's built into the service that does most of the things that I want to do, and I'm gonna have to rip it all out. So I mean, it could be worse, but
right,
you know, I'm probably gonna spend some time doing that later this week or next week, and then next week I would expect to be in a position where I could say, hey, yeah, this stuff is done, and all the scheduling pieces are there, and you'll be able to use it on a scheduled basis, whereas right now you're kind of forced to just use a single policy that's hard-coded and go from there.
That's cool.
How's Hittail doing?
It's going well. I've been pretty busy on it. I'm actually excited with what's been going on. I had some items on my list to take care of, and I really started charging at them over the past 2 weeks since we last talked about it. Basically, the marketing website design is done, and it's about 80% integrated with kind of the existing code base, so to speak. You know, there's a bunch of functionality built into the marketing website, so I have a developer working on that. And then the design for the app portion, the redesign is about 80%. And that's just comps at this point. So then it has to go through HTML, CSS, and then get integrated. So I'm hoping that that's about another couple of weeks, depending on how hard the integration is, because there's a lot of Ajax spaghetti code in there, because it was written in 2006, where there really weren't Ajax libraries, and yet it does Ajaxy stuff. So it's all raw from hand JavaScript. So it really, yeah. And I've been debating with whether or not to swap it out with jQuery now or to just have the developer get it working as is, because this is holding me up from marketing it, because I need the new design before I can market it, because I don't want to send people to this old crummy looking app. I just know that the conversion rate won't be very good. So if it weren't doing that, I would totally say, let's stop, let's take the extra couple weeks and rewrite it as jQuery. But given that even 2 more weeks is like not cool to wait to begin marketing this thing, that I'm planning to just use the code as is. It all, you know, it works. I fixed a bunch of bugs in it, and then have the other guy circle back as I start the marketing and, you know, basically rewrite it and retest it, because I know it's not going to be 2 weeks to rewrite it. I know 2 weeks will turn into 4 and that'll turn into 6 pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing I did that was kind of, you know, you do these things that are just a little bit scary. I emailed a huge chunk of the kind of the old user base. Basically, there were 1,300X users, people who had canceled or trials had run out or whatever, but who were still sending data to the tracking part of the app. Basically, they still had the tracking code installed on their website.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were still sending data, so Hittail's still analyzing it. And so I have like actual new keyword suggestions for them, and they aren't using the app. You know, their login isn't active and they aren't paying or anything. So I basically emailed about 1,300 of them. Oof. And said, yeah, from the past couple of years, probably. I mean, it wasn't just some random email. It was like, we have X new keyword suggestions for your website. You know, that was the subject of the email.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you were once signed up. You're still sending data. We'd love for you to sign up again. If you'd prefer not to, you know, we'd love for you to, we'd like to ask that you remove the code so you don't keep sending traffic to our site.
Mm-hmm.
And got a pretty good response from it, actually.
Really?
I got close to 30 signups from that. And then other people emailing saying, hey, you know, sorry, I'd forgotten. I'll remove it now. In general, it was this, yeah, it was a pleasant experience. I didn't get one person who emailed, you know, with any type of complaint or anything. And I think there was one spam complaint out of 1,300, which,
well, that's not bad.
Doing what I did is not bad, you know?
Right.
Now, the one that didn't go so well, basically Hittail has had a free plan. It was, I think it was freemium early on. And so there were still about 2,500 users who, they either never had their trial ended because there was no script to do that, or they were on a free plan, or there's something. They were just basically not paying, and yet they could still log in and were still sending traffic to the site.
Mm-hmm.
And I emailed those guys, and those guys were not nearly as responsive. I got two complaints on that one. Two people who saying like, this sucks, you're ending a free plan. I can't pay $9 a month. I'm a blog. And I'm just like, oh man, you know, so I really did have to sit there and kind of analyze those and think about whether or not I was right or not. But I did get, out of 2,500 so far, I've only gotten 5 signups. So it's a much lower conversion rate on that. I think something I realized, you know, there's this big thing about listening to customers, right? You should listen to your customers. I think you need to listen to the right customers. And it's not that these are bad people or anything. It's that I think the people who complained about this are just, they're not my customer moving forward.
Right.
Not the people I want to market to. They're not the people who benefit the most from the service. Because if they don't get $9.95 a month of value from this service, we have a mismatch.
Right.
Because the service provider, I mean, I have people on $99 plans who love it and rave about Hittail. So if they can get that much value out of it, then I know that the value is there. It's how do I find more customers like that? One guy was awesome. He emailed and said, yeah, I don't get enough value. You should make it free and make it ad supported. I'm like, oh man. Yeah, for Facebook. Yeah,
right.
It works for them, but it's like, I just don't have enough traffic.
Right.
But two guys actually did. One guy wrote, I would pay like $10 or $20 a year for this. And dude, that just doesn't even cover gas.
that doesn't even cover your bandwidth probably for that.
No.
Well, actually it probably does, but still, it's not worth the headache of you trying to track them down if they don't actually do
anything.
What do you expect?
If they send me 2 emails during the year, you know, and my support person has to do it, like I've lost money. It's just, I mean, I had a blog post a while back that was like, you can't make money charging $1 per month. And yeah, maybe you can if you have millions of customers, but 10 or 20 bucks for a small of an operation as Hittail is just not worth it. So
right.
Anyways, I really had to think about it, but I started thinking like, oh, did I make a mistake? Should I have emailed these free plan people and offered them like a really low end plan, a really, you know, cheap one? But I realized that the problem is the data in the database is so out of whack that I could have easily emailed existing customers, and I probably did. And so if they're paying $10 a month already, and then they get this email and it's like, yeah, you can do a $20 a year plan, I'm actually going to lose. I would probably lose more money by having to give them that plan than I would by the number of people who would sign up.
Right.
It's kind of what I expected, but luckily no, like I said, no real, for sending 2,500 emails last night, no real backlash, which is good, but it worked out well. And I, you know, I spent like 2 hours drafting that email. I kept rewriting and rewriting because I realized there were just going to be questions. When I sent the first 1,300 emails, I freaking got probably 80 replies the next day and then 70 replies the following day. And I realized that I did a poor job of answering all the questions because I got a lot of replies. Whereas this time I made the email a little longer and I've only received maybe 30 to 40 replies, which I would say is a good thing. Just because it was taking me a long time to answer all that. I'm still doing support, as you know, just for the first few months until I really figure the app out, and then I'll hire somebody to do it.
Right. You kind of have to figure out what all the pitfalls are going to be and what the common questions are and then provide
Absolutely.
That.
Yep. And I have a big text doc right now of the common responses, the snippets, and all that stuff. And so that'll go into basically probably into FogBugs, you know, as snippets for the new VA. But I guess the end result of all this is that what I've really been able to do is cleanse the database, because the database is just been a mess. You can't even tell who's paid and who's not.
Oh.
And so I always have to go to PayPal to figure it out. And that's what this whole effort is designed to get some signups, but it's really designed so that I have a clear view. I can just run a query and figure out how many paying people do I have? What are they paying? That kind of stuff. Because right now you can't do that.
Yeah, that always makes it hard when you just have no idea who's actually paying and who's not. You just can't even prioritize like your support emails and stuff either, because obviously you want to give some priority to the people who are actually paying for it. But
absolutely, when free users email, I want to say yes, I'll help you, but you know, I need to encourage you to sign up. Basically, if you're past your trial, you've been using this for a year for free, and you're now asking me for some support, I really do need to. You know, we don't really have a free plan. I want to be able to tell them sign up, and I couldn't do that before because I just didn't know who was paying. So mm-hmm. at least once I've gone through this, I can kind of do that.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to switch the payment provider from PayPal to something else or no?
Yeah, what I'm going to do right now, it's PayPal subscriptions, which means that when they click buy now, they go to the PayPal website, right? And then they sign up for a subscription and then they get redirected back. And the problem with that is I'm going to be moving towards a usage model where your pricing is tiered based on how many visits per month you get, because that's how much traffic essentially you send to our servers. And it's like a direct cost.
Right.
For Disk.io and stuff. So you can't do that with PayPal subscriptions because you can't modify the amount.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it's just a crappy experience. In my opinion, not very professional to wander off the site and not have a kind of a dedicated payment page on your website with an SSL cert. So,
right.
Yeah, so I will probably keep it in PayPal. I'll do Web Payments Pro, though, where it's all done on the back end and you know the person on the front end doesn't know that they're who they're paying through. They just know the credit card's being charged.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at that right now just because eventually I'm going to have to somehow allow people to pay me for Audit Shark. And for the time being, I'm just going to honestly just send them an invoice until it gets to the point where it's actually painful to do that. And yep. then I'll turn around and either completely outsource it or see how long I can go without actually having some sort of an automated payment system, and then, you know, bite the bullet and figure something out. Because I know that yep. when you're first looking for something to sign up with, if you actually have volume and you can show them that you have past revenues, it makes it easier to get a better rate. But, you know, that's one of those things that it's kind of dicey because you just don't know what sort of, I don't want to say customer experience, because I don't mean your customers. I mean you as a customer of the merchant provider has yep. like interacting with their code and dealing with their support and everything else. I mean, I think you told a story last year where you tried to get a merchant account and they said, okay, we'll get back to you. And 2 weeks later, you call them up and they say, oh yeah, this was denied because of this. And they just didn't tell you anything.
Yep.
So
that happened a number of times. That was my Authorize.net experience that was just a big waste of my time and wound up costing me, geez, probably $600-$700 by the time I was done with it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a cancellation fee. There were monthly fees that they hadn't told me about. It was crazy. I wrote a blog post called Why I'm So Happy to Be Paying PayPal $30 a Month Again or something like that.
Right.
It was just so, like, for all the crap everybody gives PayPal, I have really good experiences with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. There's that website. It's called feefighters.com. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that I would head to if you're going to do a merchant account.
Yeah, I'll probably do that at some point. It's just a matter of getting to the point where I really need to have that stuff in there, because I'm trying to eliminate as much friction as possible, at least for the startup piece of it. Because I mean, because these are banks and they're going to be putting in software that is going to be auditing their environment. So yep. I have to be a little bit sensitive about what kind of things I ask them for up front, because I need to establish trust with them first. Not to say that if I had an SSL certificate and all these other things that go along with it, that wouldn't help. But, you know, it's just a matter of what their perceptions of the site are going to be.
Absolutely. Great. I think your approach is good to not build this big billing engine up front. I mean, there's no need to do that.
Yeah. The other thing that I've been looking at is extended validation SSL certificates. Have you ever looked at those?
Yeah. They like offer more like business credibility, right? They validate that your business is legit or at least it exists and that kind of stuff.
Yep. Yep.
Yep. And it puts a big green bar in the browser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they're a lot more expensive, but for your market, I bet they will actually care about that kind of thing.
Right. Right.
You know, I worked with a guy who I consulted with him who was a legal SaaS application. And he said that lawyers absolutely would look at something like that. So he paid the extra. And I think it was like, you know, we could get an SSL cert for $100 and the eval, the extended validation was something like $700 that mm-hmm. he did. And he was like totally worth it, you know, for this market. So,
right. The SSL certificate that I got was free. But it's one of those things where, you know, it's completely generic SSL certificate. I think it only lasts for 90 days as well. And I can renew it every 90 days, but that starts to become a pain in the neck. And then for an extended validation, I can get one for probably $200 or $300 or something like that if I want to get that kind of level of authorization. They usually give you some sort of a JavaScript or some sort of little applet or something like that that you can put on your web page, and it says this has been authenticated by Komodo or GeoTrust or what have you, and it'll kind of float in either the corner or on the side of the web page or something like that. And obviously, if you click on the address bar, it'll give your additional corporate information. But the one I've actually been seriously contemplating, and although I hate to even consider spending this much money on it, is VeriSign.
That's the premium. Yeah.
Yeah.
But banks, I feel like banks are going to care. I do think they will, you know?
Yeah. I think it's like $1,500 too. Like their lower end one is $1,000, but their higher end one is something like $1,500.
I think the good news is by the time you need this, by the time you actually go and buy the SSL cert, I think you'll know if the idea is going to fly or not, right? And you'll know you'll have some income coming in. You're not going to do this tomorrow. So I bet by that time it will be worth it to do the high-end thing.
Right. It would definitely probably push people over if they see the VeriSign logo. I mean, because I'd be able to put that on my site if I were doing that, be able to say this is authenticated by VeriSign and everything else. But the issue that I have with the extended validation is that I don't really have a physical address. I do, but I don't necessarily want to publish it in my SSL certificate either.
Yep. No, that's right. I question how many sales you're going to have that are directly through your website and that don't talk to you first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if they're over the phone. I mean, some may be in person, but I imagine quite a few will be over the phone. And so I know the VeriSign thing will probably be recognized by people in the finance industry and they'll give it more credence. But obviously people who really know anything know that a cheap GoDaddy cert is, you know, as good as the VeriSign one, that it's all just name brand recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess all that to say, and until people start buying through your website, kind of sight unseen without talking to you, I actually do question if it's worth the extra, basically $1,500, because you can probably pay $50 and get a perfectly good SSL cert these days.
Right.
Generic one, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that I definitely want to test that to see how it goes, but at the same time, it's not going to be a very good test, I don't think, unless I were to go to maybe conversion rate or something like that on the site, because if I'm basing it off of number of sales, for example, my sales this coming year are not going to be in line with what next year would be like. So.
Yeah, that's not enough. You can't do sales. It'd be tough to test. I've never seen anyone actually test VeriSign versus like a GoDaddy cert.
It's funny because if you go to VeriSign's site, they have all these case studies about all these people who've gotten, you know, much more sales because of they use VeriSign logo. But everybody knows who VeriSign is, so it does count for something.
Yep. So I got a couple cool stories. One is from Jazz Panasar. You and I both know him. He came to MicroConf. He's an early, I think he was actually a charter Micropreneur Academy member. He's been building apps for a long time, and he's launched several different ones, but the most recent one is called Buzzerful, buzzerful.com. We'll put it in the show notes. And he basically, I think he pitched it at it was like an Edmonton kind of startup weekend thing. And he pitched it, and then he wound up getting local news coverage on the television. And they interviewed him, and they talked about his app. And I'll try to get that link and put it in the show notes as well. It's just really cool to see him talking to a news reporter who obviously just attached to his idea because it's so consumer-oriented.
Right.
And Buzzerful's kind of, it's a very clever idea, actually. It's, you know, the buzzer's down at the bottom of an apartment complex. Typically, people can enter your number, and it rings one of your phones, right? You can enter one phone number. And he said the problem is a lot of folks have 3-4 roommates, and so one roommate's cell phone isn't there, and you know you don't know someone's down there. So it's a simple idea. It's just you can enter your Buzzerful number in that device, and then you can set it up to ring all of your roommates, right? Because then he has control, and he can ring whoever you want. So simple, and the pricing's pretty cheap. I think it's $5 a month or something. And sure enough, you know, he got news coverage. He did pretty well at the startup competition. And the cool thing, he sent us an email. And I asked him, like, you know, you've been kind of screwing around trying to get Buzzerful launched for a long time. Like, what made the difference for you? And he said the secret to this was that he started a regular meetup of similarly minded solo entrepreneurs. And he said, his quote is, "We've been doing build-offs pretty much every other weekend where we put in a solid 12-hour day in a room together and we push each other. It's been amazing." So he actually launched a site called buildoff.org, and it's basically to kind of help give an idea of what their process is and just the philosophy behind what they've done trying to help other folks. But that was cool. And the last quote that I thought was really cool, probably the best. He said, "Launching really is an addictive drug. I don't want to do any work today. Just launch some more." Isn't that cool?
I saw the video of the news coverage. It was, the reporter was really into the product. It was pretty funny.
I know. I could never see someone, a reporter, doing that for Audit Shark.
No way.
Wait, what is it? Wait, what does it do?
I don't get it.
Wait, audits what?
Yeah, I don't get it.
Totally. The other piece, a friend of mine named Paul Denny, he just moved to Orange County from Fresno, and he's a lawyer, and he is just getting started in his career, And he right now is hustling, driving all over LA, like fighting traffic tickets for people. I mean, it's just kind of it's a cool job to get started with, but it's not something he's going to do for 20 years. And so he's trying to launch an app on the side, or a service on the side, where he wants to connect lawyers who are already at a certain court with a lawyer back at his office who needs someone to appear at that certain court at a certain time. So it's this very time sensitive thing. And it's all about, it's a marketplace, right? It's like matching people, especially in LA. You'll have a 90-mile drive, you know, to get from like one court to another. So anyways, he wanted to start this site. We were talking about it, and I was talking about how much code it would take to build this whole thing, you know, kind of like an Elance matchmaking, blah, blah, blah. So he went on, and this is like, talk about going lean, talk about micropreneur approach. He buys a domain name, legalzeal.net, and he just puts up a page with a phone number and a basic description, all text. And he's like, if you want to do this, call. And then as he's around going to these courts, filing these motions and, you know, fighting stuff for his clients, he just starts talking to the lawyers in the lobby. And he's like, hey, man, I'm starting this service. Are you interested? And so he gets like 20 or 30 names and emails and phone numbers of these guys, just in-person hustle. And then next step is someone calls him from the website. And he's like, you need someone to be at X court at X, you know, X o'clock tomorrow? Sure. So he just goes and like starts calling down his list. He finds a guy. He makes a match. So it was purely manual. There's no scalability. He got the guy's credit card and, you know, charged it. I'm trying to think. It was like he charged it $90 and he had to pay the other lawyer $80. So he's like, I made $10, right? I'm not going to grow rich doing it this way. But the thing is he like has already validated the idea. He's already got someone to pay him. The guy was happy to pay him $90. And I was like, you've basically done something that so many, like if you were a developer, you would have sat in a basement for 6 months and built the thing, right? Whereas you actually went out and did the hustle. I just thought that was really cool. It actually inspired me to go out and do a little more face-to-face hustle.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea. It's just that, looking at the website, it's very sparse. It's great that he's gone out and proven the idea. There's also this big step afterwards, which is actually expanding it.
The scale is going to be absolutely. He's going to need to hire a programmer and do all that stuff. But once he has this proprietary list, essentially, of these, even if it's 30 or 40 lawyers in the LA area, that's a pretty nice start on something like this.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's just that, you and I both know from experience that the validation of the market is just kind of one piece of it. And then there's this whole giant launch phase and then, the build phase, and then you get to the launch. But if he's doing this right now and he's just kind of manually matching people up, that's great, because when he gets to the point where he can just automate it, then he can kind of sit back. And if he's already got those mailing lists and stuff, his launch is going to be made that much easier. But it is interesting to see that somebody is taking something that's really not, I guess, a market that programmers or developers would have any access to whatsoever, and trying to build something out of it. That's the coolest part of it.
Yeah, it's neat. He basically said there are other companies already doing this, and they all do it manually, and they have these big staffs of people like manning phone banks, basically. So they'll have like 10 employees just on the phone all day, and it's all done with fax and phone calls, and then they bill the lawyer afterwards and like have to collect, and a lot of the part is getting the lawyer to pay. And so it's just, he's like, I want to do it with credit cards up front. I want to change the model. Anyway, so that's it. He told me that story and I was like, huh, that's cool, man.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
We got tweeted by Jacob Thurman, and he said, hey, Rob and Mike, I'd love to read your response to this link. And it's a link, tootsplus.com, and it says, it's a blog post. It says, is conference pricing out of control? Oh, and in quotes, he put, MicroConf 2011 was totally worth it, in my opinion. So he was just, wanting to hear our thoughts on it. Some of the subheadings in the article are like, are you receiving $1,000 worth of education? Are these conference organizers bad? Like, are they overcharging just to make a bunch of money? What's wrong with profit? I skimmed through it, of course, since I rarely read anything.
You don't even read my emails.
I forward them. VA, handle this. Just respond to Mike like I would. But basically, the premise of the article is just that spending $1,000 on a conference, is it really worth it? And it says, like, for half the price of $1,000, $500, you can buy a stack of books and resources that will teach you the bulk of what you need to know to succeed as a web developer. So the issue I have, so obviously you and I organize MicroConf, we charge around $500, $600 for that, right? we actually had complaints when we first launched it. There were some people who were like, what? Cheap conferences are like $99. Like startup conferences are $99. And right away, we had to deal with this kind of the image or the perception that people thought we were like gouging them. The reason you can do a $99 conference is because you get some big sponsor who kind of runs a thing, or you get investors who can set the agenda. And typically they're one-day regional conferences. They don't fly in speakers from out of town. Like it's a very limited scope when they do something that inexpensive. And as soon as you step to a different realm, like doing something like MicroConf where it's 2 days, where you're flying in 12 speakers, you know, you offer meals during the day, not just some box lunch, the cost gets high very quickly. And even really stripped down conferences like LessConf and MicroConf, I think LessConf is the same price as MicroConf this year. Like this, that's kind of the minimum 2 day price I think you can pull something off for, unless you get speakers to pay for themselves to fly out. And frankly, the quality of speakers we're getting, we're not going to be able to do that. There's a true cost to this stuff. And most people who've talked to us know that our goal last year was to break even on MicroConf. We wound up making a few $1,000s, which was really nice. But for the time invested, you know, obviously not, we did not make what we would normally make as consultants.
Oh God, no. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that a couple of the points are off a little bit. If you're going to sit there and compare the costs and say $500, well, I can buy 10 different books at $50 a piece, or 20 different books for $25 a piece, and you know, I'll learn all that I need to know. I don't buy into that argument, and for the simple fact that those books are not going to give you any feedback about any of your ideas. You can have what you think is the greatest idea in the world, and you go out and you start talking to people and they say, no, you're off your rocker, or yeah, that's been done and it's been done 5 different times before. Didn't you know about this service and this one? And if you sit there and you build it and rely on all the information in these books, you're going to fail. I mean, that's just the bottom line. That's what's going to happen. And you know, those books did not do what that $500 promised you. Not to say that every conference is going to be perfect, but you know, that's certainly something that's missing from the argument.
Yeah, I think the focus of this is more developer conferences, so it's a little more difficult, right? Because when you go to a developer conference, I do think that you tend to want to learn more from the presentations themselves. You go there to learn some skills. And I think that's a tough sell these days, especially if you're already an expert in an area. Going to a conference is not going to take you beyond where you are if you're already pretty knowledgeable in the area. I always go to conferences for more of a broader thing, like to expand my breadth rather than my depth of a subject.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're saying, am I going to receive $1,000 worth of education at a conference? My guess is probably not, right? Most conferences won't. But if you're more into the entrepreneur, the startup stuff, then I think you will receive more value than that just purely in the networking, right? In either meeting folks who you stay in touch with later, or like you said, getting feedback on ideas, the conversations you have, the connections you make. Now, you have to be very deliberate about that. If you're a wallflower, then you're not going to receive that amount of networking or education. I can see it going either way. I think if you put the effort into it, you can absolutely get, honestly, I think if we charged $1,000 for MicroConf, which we're not planning to do, I think we could make it worth that for most people. You know what I'm saying? I still think we could sell tickets and make it worth that.
Right.
Now, I guess at the bottom, the guy that's talking about conferences that are like $2,000. So like business of software, right? Mm. $2,400. I don't know. It's like, is pricing out of control? It's like, if you don't, enough people will get the value out of it that they'll go. And if you don't get the value out of it, then I don't know, you probably shouldn't go, because my guess is that they're not walking away from business software with buckets of money. Like Neil Davidson had said that he was breaking even or losing money on it, even at $2,000 a head.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't go to conferences that are ridiculously priced. So I guess they either are going to go out of business, or they've found an audience who does get enough value out of it that they're willing to pay that much.
Mm-hmm. But with business of software, but I don't necessarily look at the conferences. It's not like it's 9 to 5 and that's it. I mean, you spend a lot of time outside of those hours talking to people and interacting with them, either going to dinner. I think one of the things that the article probably glosses over a little bit, or maybe makes an assumption about, is who's actually paying the conference fee. Because I think that if you're running your own business, then the cost of the conference means a lot more to you than if you're just pulling it out of some budget.
Right. Like if you work for the government or work for a large company.
Right. If you're just a worker bee for some large company, they've got a conference budget or an education budget or something like that. Oh, $2,000? Sure. and they expect to pay that because that's what they pay as, you know, like an enterprise corporation. But even small companies, I mean, they expect to be paying a fair amount of money for these conferences, especially conferences where you've got 300 or 400 people. The larger a conference is, the more it costs to actually have it. I see in some cases where this is coming from, but it's not real clear to me whether or not the person who wrote this is actually paying for the conferences himself. And I suspect he is.
Right. I think my favorite quote last year from one of the MicroConf attendees is he said, you know, the conferences like this, like MicroConf, you bring all the speakers together, but it's really just an excuse to get all of us together. And he like motioned around the room and it was the attendees. You know, he's like, this is the valuable part for me, is sitting here having these hallway conversations. That's kind of the way I think about it these days.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of conferences, where do things stand on MicroConf?
Yeah, I've been talking with the person who helps us scout locations. It looks like we have pretty good leads in Tropicana, which has just invested $185 million into revamping and rehabbing the place. Mm-hmm. And Hard Rock Cafe. So they both look pretty sweet. A friend of mine just went down to Vegas this week, and I'm going to ask him about what the Tropicana looked like because he swung by there. Obviously, they are a step up from last year, and they seem like they may, if they're willing to negotiate, they may fit within kind of the parameters that you and I are looking to be in terms of budget. I'm kind of excited. Just looking at the pictures of the Hard Rock especially, it's a well-designed hotel. It just looks really nice inside. Mm-hmm. And it's a young audience, and I think it fit our vibe pretty well. And there's a lot of restaurants in there. You know, because that was kind of a drag last year, right? Is that we had the Sunday night, Monday night, and Tuesday night. We had like gatherings, and there was really only one good bar in the Riviera, whereas in the Hard Rock, I think there are like a dozen or something. I mean, it's a huge amount of restaurants and stuff. So there, we could have a lot more variety.
Yeah, I've been in the Hard Rock Cafe before, and it's fairly large.
Cool. So now that, I mean, certainly that's not final by any means. We're just in early talks, and I think I am going to contact another hotel. Should be good. Then we'll have some dates. I'm thinking we try to go as early as we can, like April or May.
Yeah, I think April would be good to shoot for. Yeah. Obviously, it kind of depends on what their schedule is, but I think to me, April is preferable.
Vegas is nice in April.
Yeah.
You know?
Weather can't possibly be any worse than New England, so.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's still like 30 degrees in New England in April. If you're listening and you have a question or a comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690. You can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. We'd love to have a review in iTunes. You can just search for Startups and we'll be in the top 3 or 4. You can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes or RSS at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com, where a transcript is also available. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.